For those that don't know me, I'm Joe Hollander, Chair of the Palmerston North Defence Heritage Advisory Group. And in conjunction with the City Library, we host these military history presentations on a fairly regular basis. Our program during the course of the year tries to focus on anniversaries. And so tonight we're looking at the 80th anniversary of World War II, in particular the North African campaign. And I'm not going to steal either of Glyn's thunder or his worship's notes, but I just wanted to introduce the fact that we are focusing, particularly the evening presentations, on anniversaries, and hence the reason for tonight's presentation, looking at what went on 80 years ago during the period sort of May through July 1942. I think without further ado, can I call upon His Worship the Mayor, Grant Smith, to come and introduce tonight's session and also our speaker. So thanks very much, Grant.
Kia ora tātou, thank you, Joe. Look, good evening, everybody. And look, it hardly seems that long ago that we're all together gathered at Anzac Day, actually, with commemorations. And also, a few of you were here when I was for the book Global Conflict, Global Catastrophe by Auckland University's Professor Arvinhas. And actually, it wasn't that long ago that we were here for the launch too. The front line, images of New Zealand in the Second World War, an inspired COVID lockdown project by tonight's our presenter, and I have to get this right because it's changed, Lieutenant Colonel retired, Dr. Glyn Harper. But look, with the numerous publications that Glyn's written, and he's really earned himself some status at forums such as these. Among his books is The Battle for North Africa, El Alamein, A Turning Point of World War II, from 2017. And without second-guessing him, it's fair to suppose that that will probably form the basis of this evening's presentation as we mark the 80th anniversary of the significant World War II battle. Now, I'm privileged, courtesy of the families, to have on display in the Mayor's office the replicas of the medals awarded to two men born in this area who served their country at El Alamein in North Africa. And I brought the display frames along tonight just to provide a little bit of extra flavour for this evening's presentation. Brigadier Leslie Andrew and Second Lieutenant Keith Elliott were both awarded the VC Victoria Cross. Ashurst born Brigadier Andrew is a corporal for his heroism during World War I and the Battle of Passchendaele in 1917. And in World War II, while under the command of Leslie Andrew, Second Lieutenant Keith Elliott, who was born in Apiti and attended Fielding Ag High School, received his VC for actions as a company commander during the First Battle of El Alamein in July 1942, 80 years ago today. I'll let Glyn go into more detail of the action, but having these medals establishes a real local connection for what was a vital battle fought 8 decades ago in North Africa. And this North African campaign really touched many New Zealand families. My own great uncle fought there. He was taken prisoner of war. And actually, I can recall him talking about meeting that very man there, the German General Rommel, who I can recall he was somewhat impressed with as a leader, even if he was the enemy. So some acknowledgements tonight. The families that have allowed these medals to, and they're replicas, they're not the real ones, just in case you're thinking something else. But it's fantastic that those families do let them be seen. And others that have made the military heritage or history events possible. To Joe and your team, and there's a few of your members here from the City's Defence Heritage Group. Everyone from the Engineer Corps, Memorial Centre at Linton, the Palmerston North City Library Heritage Team, to Ralph and Joe, from Massey University, Dr. David Littlewood, members of the New Zealand Defence Force, and Returned Services and Association members. And that brings me back to Glyn, whose research and knowledge has added immeasurably to our understanding of the contributions made by New Zealanders in these brutal conflicts that defined the 20th century. And it's thanks to the breadth and the depth of Glyn's research, and also to the wide range of perspectives, including his books for children, that has made his work so accessible and admired. We also are hugely appreciative of how his approach to history, along with his own experience as a soldier, has helped to keep the military and home front sacrifices made by our forebearers front and centre. I hope that some of this scholarship can be incorporated into the revamped school history syllabus, so the coming generations of Kiwis have a greater appreciation of that era's challenges and sacrifices. And as a council and city, we're proud of our deep historical affiliations and ties that Palmerston North has with the New Zealand Defence Force. And we acknowledge how Glyn's work has contributed to the city's mana as a hub, not only for today's Defence Force activity, but as a centre for research, scholarship, and a repository for the country's military heritage. So thank you, Glyn, for making yourself so available, and for the history you've brought to light, the stories that you've told, and for the accompanying high-quality presentations and images that really make them so more tangible. So we're eagerly looking forward to what I'm sure will be a great presentation tonight. So ladies and gentlemen, I'll just invite Glyn up to stage. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that very warm welcome, Joe and Mayor Grant Smith. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here yet again. And I'll kick off with this slide here of the most photogenic general of the Second World War. There are more photographs taken of him, and there are more photographs of him in our albums and of New Zealand soldiers than there are of General Freyberg. And I'm not sure why that is, but I guess he's very photogenic. As has been mentioned already tonight, 80 years ago this month, the 2nd New Zealand Division was rushed down from Syria to Egypt to help stem Rommel's latest advance. The British position in Egypt was under threat following a chain of serious military disasters. More disasters were ahead, including for the New Zealanders, before the almost imperceptible turn of the tide against the Germans that makes up the history of the Second World War. My talk today outlines what happens in these critical months in North Africa, and I'm talking about June, July, and through to early September, and I will cover the following in my presentation. I'm going to look at why they were in North Africa to start with. I'm going to look at this gentleman, Rommel, and why he is so important. Look at some of the early campaigns, particularly Operation Crusader, and then focus on Alamein and the problems that occurred there. So why were they in North Africa to begin with? This was an area of strategic importance to both Britain and Italy. For both, this was a vital area of interest. As the historian Barry Pitt would describe it, Egypt was the fulcrum of empire. And of course the Italians had, under Mussolini, had visions of creating a second Roman Empire in this region. For the British, it was also the only place they could fight a land campaign after they had been ejected from the European mainland. And it is part of their way of war, this indirect approach where they will try and strangle the weaker enemy, according to the German Admiral Raeder. Why was Germany there? They were reluctantly there. They were supporting a struggling ally, and the resources they committed were actually rather small. They, for most of the period that we're talking about, and particularly in 1942, we're talking about a corps of the Afrika Corps, which is largely made up of two Panzer and one Light Division. So that's the 15th and the 21st Panzer and the 90th Light Division. Now, a Light Division is a division that has no artillery assets, so they do not have a lot of firepower in the region. What they do have, though, is Hitler's favourite general, Rommel, a dashing cavalry commander, and he is ordered to take things slowly, but he never did. Instead of waiting till we build up forces, he attacked very quickly, and in his first advance, he pushes the British all the way out of Libya and back across into Egypt, with the exception of Tobruk. And you can see Tobruk up in the corner there. I'll tell a little bit more about that in a minute. And in the process, he managed to capture Britain's best field commander, General Richard O'Connor. The only thing that he, the only place he didn't capture in Libya was Tobruk, which held out. It became a fortress. It's isolated. It is not captured. It becomes part of Australian folklore, despite the fact that many British and Poles also fight in the defence of Tobruk. Tobruk becomes an obsession with Rommel. He is determined to capture it. He makes many attempts to do so, and the British build it up as a great propaganda victory. And it becomes their goal to actually push the Deutsches Afrika Korps and the Italians out of eastern Libya, known as Cyrenaica, and relieve this besieged fortress of Tobruk. They make two attempts to do so in May and June 1941, and they are both dismal failures. Operations Brevity, so well named because they called it off after a few hours, and Operation Battle Axe. And what happens after the failure to relieve Tobruk is that Churchill decides he needs a new commander in this region, somebody with a bit of force and vigour. So he relieves Wavell, who was a very astute and capable commander, and replaces him with General Claude Auchinleck, who had impressed Churchill with the forces he was able to muster to fight in Iraq. And Auchinleck is ordered to prepare a major offensive to drive Rommel and the Axis forces out of eastern Libya and relieve the siege of Tobruk. And this is Operation Crusader, the New Zealand Division's first campaign in the Western Desert, and it's a pivotal moment in their development. This is the plan for Operation Crusader. Won't make much sense. Basically, it is a very faulty plan. It divides the British 8th Army into two separate groups, infantry in the north, carrying out their own battles against the fortresses of Solomon on the border in Bardia, and hopefully marching on Tobruk. But the bulk and main effort would be made by an armoured corps who would swan off into the desert, somehow find the Afrika Korps, and have a major tank battle way out in the desert, away from everybody else. This emphasised British faulty doctrine. Why? Because the armour and infantry would be fighting separate battles. The commander had decided, and some people say this is an Indian Army thing, that the best infantry formation of the time was either a brigade group or a jock column, something even smaller than a brigade group, mixture of a little bit of artillery, a little bit of infantry, and maybe a tank or two. They were really not capable of causing any major damage. The British, the New Zealand official, she says they could make scratches, but no real damage. The best infantry formations were broken up into these brigade groups, and one person called it, it's like the Battle of the Cowpats, because if you look at a map, there's all these things on a map, and they look like a cowpat. This is a hotly contested, confusing battle, which Rommel initially won, but he then made a silly decision to drive to the wire and leave his infantry to deal with what is happening behind him. It was the New Zealand Division that does most of the hard fighting in Operation Crusader. And for a time, they also opened up a thinly held corridor to Tobruk. But when Rommel recovered from this drive to the wire, he came back and his armour overwhelmed the infantry positions, the New Zealand positions around Belhamid and Sidi Rezegh. He basically ran out of supplies and decided he had to fall back to Gazala and then to Alagilia, and he left some 30,000 Italians to be captured. But for 8th Army, the cost was incredibly high. 8th Army suffered 18,000 casualties, and New Zealand losses were extremely high, some 4,620. This is the most costly battle for New Zealand of the Second World War. And this, it's surprising that this is their first success, in inverted commas, but they've suffered more casualties than they lost in the two disasters of Greece and Crete before them. There was a strong feeling throughout 8th Army, and particularly in the New Zealand Division, that the 8th Army had won this victory by default and that it had been undeserved. And this was confirmed when on the 21st of January, Rommel advanced again and pushed the 8th Army back to the Gazala line. Now, Operation Crusader, while it had been a success, was really costly. And General Freyberg, the New Zealand Divisional Commander, did not get on with Auchinleck, did not trust Auchinleck, and did not trust the doctrine that the 8th Army was fighting under. He was convinced that dispersing forces into these brigade groups would lead to disaster, and invariably it did. He wanted to get the 2nd New Zealand Division away from 8th Army, and he asked for permission to leave it, to go off somewhere where he could train and concentrate his division and train it as a division. So they are sent off for an interlude in Syria. They're sent to do some garrison duty, and for the first 5 months of 1942, they are in Syria alongside the 9th Australian Division, who's also in that location. They use this time in Syria for some intensive training, but always as a division, as a fighting division, not as a jock column and not as a brigade group. And it is here in Syria that the artillery brigades are concentrated, and they develop the artillery fire patterns that they would use for the rest of the war, patterns they called stonks and murder, which would be emulated by every other British division after 1942. The brainchild, I have to say, of Brigadier Steve Weir, who's rated one of the best gunner officers of the Second World War. So for the first 5 months, they are in Syria training, and training hard, and training as a division. And back in North Africa, both sides are sitting on the Gazala line, planning their next big battle, and it is Rommel who gets in first. On the 27th of May, 1942, he opens up the Battle of Gazala. Now, despite the fact that the British 8th Army enjoys a 3-to-1 superiority in tanks, a 3-to-2 superiority in guns, and a 4-to-1 superiority in men, this becomes 8th Army's worst defeat. They outnumber the Deutsche Afrika Korps and Panzer Army Africa in everything, in tanks, in guns, and in men, but they lose the Battle of Gazala. It becomes their worst ever defeat. And one of the things they also lose is this port of Tobruk. And this is a devastating loss. The Gazala battle, wrote David Fraser, a fine soldier and also historian, and I'm quoting from what he wrote, constituted a serious and avoidable reverse for British arms. Niall Barr has written that at times the 8th Army commander, General Ritchie, seemed to be making decisions in slow motion. And another historian accused Ritchie, the 8th Army commander, of, quote, letting the day slip by in a blur of indecisiveness. These criticisms, while they are justified, are a little harsh. Ritchie had never commanded an army like this in a field before. In fact, the last field commander he'd been a battalion commander, and had been set up to fail. And I have a quote from Barry Pitt, which I think sums this up. Sandwiched as he was between Auchinleck's determination to hold his hand at almost every stage of the operation, and indifference to his opinion of his corps commanders, who basically ignored his orders, and almost contempt for them from lower levels, it is not surprising that Ritchie's grip on the battle as it developed was at first weak and in the end non-existent. But Pitt is also right when he claims, and I'm writing, quoting from his book, ultimate responsibility for the disasters of Gazala lies with Auchinleck, because it was Auchinleck who appointed Ritchie and then watched him flounder. And even when it was clear that Ritchie was losing the Battle of Gazala and didn't have the command skills or the intellect to command 8th Army against Panzer Army, Auchinleck took no immediate action. The Battle of Gazala starts on the 27th of May. Auchinleck does not relieve Ritchie until the 25th of June, which is a long time when things are going wrong in a big battle. And by then, it was far too late to avoid the disaster. And of course, one of the disasters was the loss of this fortress of Tobruk, which the Germans captured in one day. Here they are, they're on the Red Arrows, and they drive right into the port of Tobruk. The symbol of British defiance was captured on the 21st of June with a garrison of 35,000 men. More men were captured at Tobruk than Rommel had in his army at the time. Okay? And I've got to say, Rommel was really pleased and was immediately promoted to Field Marshal by Adolf Hitler. And it was a huge blow to the biggest setback of the war in North Africa, because nobody had expected it to fall and nobody had expected it to be captured in just one day. And because it was captured so fast, it also meant that that Rommel was able to capture all the supplies he needed to continue the offensive. Included amongst what he captured at Tobruk were 3 million rations, so rations to feed men for 3 million, 7,000 tonnes of water, 1.5 million gallons of petrol. And he would put that to really good use. On the day of its capture, Rommel wrote to his wife, "Tobruk, it was a wonderful battle." For Winston Churchill, then in the United States, this was his worst moment of the war. Churchill learned the news from President Franklin Roosevelt, and at first didn't believe it, said, no, it can't be true, it must be German propaganda. But he soon found out it was true, and he was mortified. He would later write that Tobruk's loss, and I'm quoting from his history, was one of the heaviest blows I can recall during the war. Not only were its military effects grievous, but it affected the reputation of the British armies. It was a bitter moment. Defeat is one thing, disgrace is another. And as I mentioned before, while Rommel would say it's a wonderful battle, for 8th Army it had been anything but wonderful. With and these are some of the things that their soldiers were writing about it. With the fall of Tobruk, one soldier wrote, "The British humiliation was complete." Another soldier would write, "We have been outgunned, outmaneuvered, outgeneraled, in other words, led up the garden path," wrote one veteran. Another recalled the bitterness and bewilderment equally well. He wrote, and I'm quoting from a letter he wrote to his family, "Let me try to analyse the last few months. We started out as a well-equipped regiment, well-trained, good administration, very good officers and NCOs, plenty of experience in tank warfare in the desert. It boiled down to one thing. The enemy had outgunned us with superior armament and firepower, plus a few very bad decisions by the high command. We must try again. It was like seeing your favourite football team reaching the final and getting licked 6-0. But I guess that feels like the Auckland Blues at the moment. But never mind, sorry.
Don't mention the war.
Well, I can't bring support up, yeah. Catching the bewilderment, bitterness and loss of confidence, Albert Martin of the 2nd Rifle Brigade wrote a telling entry in his diary 2 days before Tobruk was captured. It read, "Everything has been a jumble. Does anyone up the top know what they are doing?" The British Army fell back, initially at Mers and Matruh, and then fell back to the Alamein line, to the Alamein position, some 60 miles from Alexandria. While all this Gazala battle is happening, while all this despondency is there, and certainly a degree of panic, the call goes out from Auchinleck that he needs the 2nd New Zealand Division and the 9th Australian Division back in Egypt as quickly as possible. and they are rushed down and they actually get there far quicker than anticipated. Now, the New Zealand Commander General Bernard Freyberg cabled his government on the 24th of June after arriving in Egypt. "There is no doubt our forces in the Western Desert have suffered a major reverse, and the situation at the moment causes anxiety. General Auchinleck has a difficult task here with inadequate resources, an inferior tank gun, and an inferior anti-tank gun. What shocked Freyberg most was the confusion that gripped 8th Army at the time, especially the lack of clear direction from its leaders. Freyberg later reported to the New Zealand government, "This continued vacillation shook me, but not nearly so much as the tempo of the troops coming down the City Barani Road. What I was most anxious about was not to allow panic orders to put us in an impossible position." And he argues about being locked up in Mirza Matru. They want to send him to a wadi. He argues about that. And in the end he says, "Look, I'll go and hold an escarpment called Minka Kaim, and there we can use our powerful guns to the full." The 2nd New Zealand Division took up a position on an escarpment called Minka Kaim, just south of Mirza Matru, in the belief that it would take part in a major set-piece battle that would halt the Panzer Army in its tracks. Its orders from 13 Corps, and I'm quoting from the operation order, quote, "to secure a box in the area of Minka Kaim in order to deny the escarpment to the enemy and to operate all round with mobile columns to attack and delay the enemy advance." Unknown to the New Zealanders, though, was the fact that Auchinleck had changed his mind and decided against fighting a set-piece battle at Mirza Matru. He and his Chief of Staff, Eric Dorman-Smith, were convinced that the 8th Army couldn't stand there and that it needed to fall back even further to the Alamein position. Holding orders were to be the order of the day as the main elements of 8th Army withdrew to Alamein to make their stand there. This was a critical decision in two ways, because Mirza Matru was always going to be the final point of retreat as the worst possible case, and they're going back 150 miles even further. And it is also a huge decision because nobody told the New Zealanders that they were withdrawing. And the New Zealanders took up their position on Minka Kaim, ready to deal what they thought would be a crushing blow to Panzer Army. So on the afternoon of the 26th of June 1942, so 80 years ago next week, 2nd New Zealand Division minus a brigade formed up on the escarpment at Minka Kaim. On its left flank, and you can see it up over here, was one armoured division with 159 tanks, of which 60 were the new Grant tanks, and an Indian brigade on its right flank. The next day, on the morning of the 27th of June, the Africa Corps, which only had 39 serviceable tanks, approached the Minka Kaim position. As they did so, the 1st Armoured Brigade and the Indian Brigade took off. Okay, they left. Okay, and they left the New Zealanders on the Minka Kaim position. And 21st Panzer Division, I'm just going to leave here, came across the escarpment here, okay, moved all the way along here, of course they've been fighting all the time, and then wheeled south and west to envelop the New Zealanders on the Minka Kaim position. Basically, the New Zealanders were surrounded. With his division engaged by the enemy on three sides and German tanks astride his line of retreat, Lieutenant General Bernard Freyberg was anxious about the safety of his division and the 10,000 soldiers on the Minka Kaim position. He tried to contact the Corps Commander, General Gott, to be told that the 1st Armoured Division were going and that he should think about doing something similar very soon. Later that afternoon, as he was searching for a route to escape from Minka Kaim, Freyberg was struck in the neck by a shell splinter, which basically incapacitated him for the rest of the battle. Things did not look good for the New Zealanders. And this is part of historical folklore. They did break out. On the evening of the 27th of June, the New Zealand Division attempted its breakout. It launched an attack with one of its infantry brigades on foot, with bayonets fixed, to cut a path through. Explaining this action to a worried New Zealand government, the acting commander of the division, Lindsay Ingalls, explained that this tactic was, I'm quoting from his letter, they were crash tactics, that is, a charge right through, end of quote. He assured the government that it had been, quote, most effective. Effective it may have been, but it was also disorganised and chaotic, and the New Zealanders were lucky that the Afriki Corps was taken by surprise and in a very weak position. This was also the action that a New Zealand officer so distinguished himself as to be considered for a bar to his already awarded Victoria Cross. This was one Charles Upham, who's actually at the front of all these vehicles with a haversack full of grenades and basically throwing them to blast a way through. The New Zealand breakout from Inca Kaim punched a hole through the German positions. The Germans were most anxious to try and seal it, but by the time they did, some 10,000 New Zealanders escaped captivity on Winkha Kaim. It seemed almost a miracle that casualties and the damage was very slight. The New Zealanders rejoined the 8th Army, now formed up along the Alamein position to the Katara Depression. The 8th Army was greatly weakened by its headlong retreat. In early July, it was down to just one complete infantry division, the newly arrived 9th Division, an incomplete infantry division, the New Zealanders, a brigade group and remnants of other divisions now dispersed into ineffective battle groups and jock columns. The 8th Army had lost over 1,000 tanks in just 17 days of fighting in June. It was down to 137 tanks now, of which only 36 were the latest Grant tanks. Its morale was poor. As Major General John Harding, at the time a senior staff officer, recalled, he was in Cairo, and I'm quoting from a statement he made after the war, the morale of the army was shattered. They were in a state of confusion and they had been seriously defeated. The day after the New Zealanders escaped from Minka Kaim, a confident Rommel wrote a letter to his wife in Berlin. And this is what he said in his letter. We're still on the move, and we hope to keep it up until the final goal. It takes a lot out of one, of course, but it's the chance of a lifetime. The enemy is fighting back desperately with his air force. Postscript, P.S. Italy in July still might be possible. Get passports. He's talking about a holiday. Have any holiday in July. On the 1st of July, Rommel reached the Alamein position, but he was down to only 55 serviceable tanks and his troops were exhausted. Instead of waiting, though, this was Rommel and he was determined to seize his chance of a lifetime. He took the decision to push on in the hopes of breaking through and eventually reaching Cairo. The scene was set for the first battle of Alamein and Rommel's holiday in Italy was going to have to wait. And we are now at the first battle of El Alamein. Auchinleck sacked the army commander Ritchie on the 25th of June and took over personal command of the army. They took the decision to make a stand at El Alamein. Why? Because there was no open flank. You have the Mediterranean at sea at one end, at the north end, and a sea of soft sand, the impassable Katara Depression at the other. It could not be flanked, and on the 1st of July 1942, Rommel crashed into this position, hoping to advance and scatter them and advance on Cairo. He was now down to 40 tanks. The numbers keep changing, because they keep breaking down, and then they repair them and bring them back in, and he was existing solely on the supplies he captured at Tobruk. There was some panic in Cairo and Alexandria. The British fleet sailed away from Alexandria. In Cairo, it was known as Ash Wednesday, as government officials started burning documents. But the 3 weeks of sporadic fighting in July was the first battle of El Alamein, and it would be a decisive battle. Here we are in the early days. At first, things went very well for 8th Army, and Rommel's advance was stopped in its tracks. On the 1st of July, he did capture the depression of Deir el-Shem after intense fighting. It had been well defended by an Indian brigade. It cost the attacking 21 Panzer Division 18 of its precious 30 tanks to do so. The British 1st Armoured Division at the time was firmly established on the Wisat Ridge with over 100 tanks, of which 38 were the new Grant tanks, and it was liberally protected by 6-pounder anti-tank guns. So on the 2nd of July, when Rommel attacked the Wisat Ridge, it was a dismal failure that led to more losses that he could not afford. On the 3rd of July, the 1st Armoured Division, in conjunction with other units from 13 Corps, including the New Zealanders, launched a local counter-attack from the Wisat Ridge against the Axis southern flank. There was some sporadic fighting in the north, but the Axis made no headway. And the 2nd New Zealand Division on this day destroyed one of the best and reliable Italian formations, the Arietti Armoured Division, primarily through the use of its artillery. This prompted Rommel on the 4th of July to halt the offensive, build up his defences, and start building up his supplies for another attack later on. So the first few days in July, up to about the 5th of July, everything's gone really well for 8th Army and not very well for Rommel. In fact, Rommel records his disappointment in his diary. This is what he wrote in his diary after these few days. More and more British tanks were arriving at the front. General Auchinleck, who had meanwhile taken over command at Alamein, was handling his forces with very considerable skill and tactically better than General Ritchie had done. He seemed to view the situation with decided coolness, for he was not allowing himself to be rushed into accepting a second-best solution by any moves that we made. And Rommel was absolutely shocked by the loss of the Arietti division, and he recorded in his diary, "This reverse took us completely by surprise. The attack has now come to a standstill." The next day, Rommel wrote a letter to his wife that unfortunately reflected the conditions of his forces and also cancelled his holiday. "Unfortunately," he wrote, "things are not going as I should like. The resistance is too great and our strength is exhausted. However, I still hope to find a way to achieve our goal. I'm rather tired and fagged out." After the first 5 days, Rommel's advance had been effectively halted, but it's after this time that things deteriorated for 8th Army. This was because Auchinleck, aware of how precarious Rommel's strength was through ultra intercepts, decided the time was right to launch a series of larger forces by 8th Army, designed to eject Rommel from Egypt and send him back across the border in Libya. His recently defeated army was in no condition to move to the offensive. And here's what some people have said about this change. According to Brigadier Howard Kippenberger, at a time when 8th Army was in, I'm quoting from a letter he wrote, was in dire need of nursing back to health, Auchinleck undertook a series of unnecessary and unsuccessful counter-offensives. They were very badly coordinated and they cost 14,000 casualties. Kippenberger did not think, and I'm quoting from his letter again, that a single one of these were necessary. Brigadier George Clifton, who would actually be captured and befriended before Rommel in these attacks, actually echoed Kippenberger's view. The Bacon and Splendor attacks, Operation Bacon is the Wisat Ridge, which I'm going to talk about soon. Operation Splendor is the Australian attacks on Mitarrhea Ridge, which I'll also talk about. They were regrettable and cost the 8th Army thousands of the best infantry in the world to no purpose whatsoever. Even the senior staff officer, Francis de Guingamp, thought that the large offensives were a mistake. The troops undertaking them were either too tired and it was difficult to see the objective. No large-scale exploitation was that possible. These failed offensives thoroughly undermine any remaining confidence in the 8th Army's senior commanders. They included, and I don't have all of them, but I'm including the most important ones. On the 9th of July, the 9th Australian Division attacked Tel Elisha, the Hill of Jesus, Tells Are Hills, and 1st South African Division captured another hill, and that was the only success of these offensive operations. That was the exception. On the 15th of July, under Operation Bacon, 2nd New Zealand Division and 5th Indian Division carried out an assault on the Wisat Ridge, which is going to be one of our worst disasters of the war. on the 17th of July, on the 22nd of July, the Australian Division tried to capture Mitarrhea Ridge, which they named Ruin Ridge for appropriate reasons, and they failed as well. On the 22nd of July, the New Zealanders also attacked the Aumrea Ridge. An Australian infantryman summarised the 22nd of July as part of Operation Splendor, this attack on Ruin Ridge. I'm sorry about the language, but they are Australians. He described it in his diary, it was a balls up altogether, and that pretty much summed it up. 22nd of July is a particularly bad day because we also have the 23rd Armoured Brigade's charge to nowhere. The 23rd Armoured Brigade had just arrived in North Africa. This was its first offensive operation, and two regiments of the brigade were sent off in a balaclava-like charge with guns to the right of them, guns to the left of them and behind them, and a further striking parallel of the mistaken orders. Nobody actually understood what they were actually supposed to do. This foolish action was hastily conceived on the spot by General Gott, the corps commander, and General Gatehouse, the divisional commander, after a brief early morning consultation, and it achieved nothing but heavy casualties. This charge to nowhere cost 23rd Armoured Brigade most of the tanks. It started that morning with 106 tanks, and it commenced the charge at 8 o'clock. That evening, only 7 remained. Okay, they've been annihilated in one day for no purpose. And I'm just going to have a quick look at the Wisat Ridge, because this encapsulates some of these problems as well. And I'll lump Aumrea into it, because Aumrea is a smaller scale. On the 15th of July 1942, the New Zealanders carried out a night attack on the Wisat Ridge, which would be the worst disaster of the war, and followed closely by the Aumrea disaster as well a week later. What happens is that they are tasked to take this feature, which I've got to say the British were occupying at the start of the month, but decided to leave it and then try to capture it again when the Germans reoccupied it. They carry out a night attack, and they actually, it's a very successful night attack, but they can't bring their support weapons forward, nor can they dig in, because nobody has told them that the Wisat Ridge is solid rock. So they cannot dig any shelter, and they cannot take their support weapons to help them on the ridge. Now, if you look up here, I'm going to have to walk away again. This is the 4th New Zealand Infantry Brigade on the Wisat Ridge. 20th Battalion on the left, on their right flank, the left flank, last 19th Battalion, units of other battalions. This armour brigade, 2 armour brigade, is supposed to be here, okay, protecting their left flank. They ain't there. They've got their orders, and their orders are be prepared to assist the New Zealanders. They are there on a hill watching the New Zealanders being overrun by the tanks of 15th Panzer and German tanks coming in behind them, watching them through binoculars. Okay, Kippenberger runs up and says, why aren't you over there? He said, we're following our orders, we're prepared to assist, but we're not going to do it. You know, but this was an absolute disaster. And it's repeated again at the Aumrea Depression a week later to another brigade, but on a smaller scale. 6 infantry battalions go in on action on the Wisat Ridge. Only one comes out, which is fit for further action. And this is one of the reasons why 4th Infantry Brigade is later converted to armour. The New Zealand Brigadier Howard Kippenberger, whose brigade is getting annihilated on the Wisat Ridge, described it in a letter to the official historian, I'm quoting from it, as a tragedy of misdirection and mismanagement. Then, in a letter to his wife, he wrote the following. Things are not being done right here in 8th Army. You could have run this battle better than the General Gott and General Auchinleck, because they're both more like sergeant majors than a general. Okay, this is what he wrote. Unfortunately, that letter was intercepted by the German censors and given to General Auchinleck, who was not very happy, and Freiburg was told to discipline Kippenberger. And he was told to tell Kippenberger this, and I'm quoting from the director tells him to discipline this man. Kippenberger's letter shows a complete disregard of censorship regulations and discloses information that might be of value to the enemy if it fell into their hands. I think the enemy probably knew all these things except about Mrs. Kippenberger and how good she was. Just slight diversion. If you look at Freiburg in that photograph, this is after Minke Keim, and you can see the scar on his neck caused by the artillery round. very, very close to death. Very lucky. Extra centimetre would have probably taken him out. This constant failure of British armour to coordinate their efforts with infantry left a legacy of most intense distrust and almost hatred of our armour, wrote Kippenberger some years after the war. Now, I've got to say, too, back in the United Kingdom, the British government was getting absolutely sick of these disasters after disaster. So much so that Winston Churchill faced a vote of no confidence in his leadership in mid-June. He actually won it, 776-25 against, with 40 abstentions, but he had had enough of these defeats, particularly stung by the loss of Tobruk. He travelled to Egypt to meet Auchinleck, talked to his staff officers, talked to officers in the 8th Army, and it became very clear to Winston Churchill that morale was low and that the army had no faith whatsoever in their leaders or in their own abilities. And Churchill took the hard decision that Auchinleck and most of his senior staff had to go. Now, I think the South African historian Aga Hamilton actually had Auchinleck's measure when he wrote to Kippenberger, and I'm quoting from his letter. Auchinleck as a commander was hopeless, but not because he was a fool. He possessed, in fact, a first-class military brain and good fighting spirit. What he lacked was leadership. He never seemed to be able to get anybody to obey him. Let me tell you, that is a fatal flaw in a general. Okay, if people don't obey you, you're in big trouble. It was an astute assessment and confirmation of A.G. Hamilton's last point. Howard Kippenberger confirmed Auchinleck's lack of leadership. According to Kippenberger, I'm quoting from a letter he wrote, I myself heard him say, it's like everything else in this army. If I want to get a thing done, I have to do it myself. Okay? What an admission of failure of leadership. And, to this, Freyberg added that Auchinleck, and I'm quoting from a letter he wrote, was one of the finest characters imaginable, but he was stubborn and one of the worst judges of men. And Freyberg would go on to say that until the appointments of Montgomery and Alexander in August 1942, I'm quoting his letter, the prestige of British generalship was at its lowest possible point in the war. I have to say, most men of 8th Army, and particularly the New Zealanders, were pleased to see Auchinleck go. And here we have the two new brooms that are coming in to clean this army up. Lieutenant General Bernard Law Montgomery received command of 8th Army when Churchill's chosen successor was killed when his plane was shot down. Now, Montgomery's appointment as commander of 8th Army caused considerable trepidation, particularly amongst senior British officers. He was not regarded as a good chap or one of the team. In fact, his biographer would describe Montgomery during the interwar period, and I'm quoting from what he said, he was undoubtedly the most unpopular general in the British Army. Freyberg would write to Kippenberger the following, he was very unpopular and was criticised by British officers for no reason other than he was said not to be a good fellow. And Freyberg would say, this gives me a certain feeling of confidence. Kippenberger recalled the news of Montgomery's appointment, and I'm quoting from Infantry Brigadier, no New Zealander had heard of him, and our British friends were unenthusiastic. One British Brigadier told me he was understood to be mad, and more cheerfully that it'd certainly get rid of some of the dead wood. His first meeting with Montgomery left Kippenberger feeling, I'm quote, very much stimulated, while Freyberg was delighted to learn that Montgomery told him that this mania for breaking up military organisations was over, you will keep your division as a fighting division. And then we move on to the turning point with Montgomery in charge. There was a stalemate in July through August on the Alamein line. Rommel was facing huge supply difficulties and he knew time was against him. He would make one last attempt to break through, and this is the Battle of Alam Halfa. But 8th Army under Montgomery knew the attack was coming, basically through those ultra intercepts, and they were very well prepared. Here's what is happening. This is the African Corps. They have decided to attack in the southern section of the line, just let me go on a little bit. We're going to sweep around this Alam Halfa Ridge, send some people to attack the British troops from behind, the rest will drive on to Cairo. They don't get past the Alam Halfa Ridge because as they're coming through here, they face a dense belt of minefields. Montgomery has prepared a massive artillery concentration which will pound them as they go through those minefields. The Desert Air Force under Air Vice Marshal Cunningham are now involved in army plans and they're now fighting jointly, and they make good use of Enigma intelligence. They are now relying on brute force and joint action. But there's a but here. While this is a turning point, there are two small counterattacks launched on the 3rd of September when the Africa Corps is withdrawing. They're both on this map. 2nd New Zealand Division launches Operation Beresford. The Australians in the north launch Operation Bulimba, and they are both dismal failures. It shows that Montgomery has a lot to do to bring this army up to speed. But Alum Halfa is a defeat for Rommel, and morale in 8th Army rises, and Montgomery's reputation is enhanced. This is a significant turning point in the battle for North Africa, and Rommel was one of the commanders to recognise it as such. Ever the realist, this is what Rommel said about the Battle of Alum Halfa. With the failure of this offensive, our last chance of gaining the Suez Canal is gone. We now expect that the full production of British industry, and more important, the enormous industrial potential of America, which consequent to a declaration of war, was now fully harnessed to the enemy's cause. It would finally turn the tide against us. Other people have made telling assessments of Alum Halfa as well. General Alexander, in his post-war dispatch of the North African campaign, wrote about Alum Halfa, and I'm quoting from his dispatch, "It was far more important than it would appear." It was the last chance for a German victory there and the beginning of the turn of the tide against the Axis. More significantly, it also restored a lost faith in British leadership and a confidence in their own fighting abilities. One veteran wrote of the importance of this victory, and I'm quoting from a letter he wrote, "It's in the proof it gave that British tanks and infantry could stand up to the Germans and inflict a crushing defeat." As a result, morale rose to great heights and confidence was re-established. As Alexander wrote, reflecting the views in many in 8th Army, and I'm quoting from a letter he wrote, "I now feel sure that we should be able to defeat the enemy when we are ready to take the offensive." As another veteran of this battle stated, "It was our first obvious victory and a tremendous morale boost. At last, a plan that actually worked." Montgomery may not have taken the opportunities presented in this battle, but he had achieved his main objective. Alexander was correct when he wrote that Montgomery handled his first battle in the desert with, quote, skill and care. As General Horrocks would state, this was to meet the Panzer Army head on and not be beaten or make any major mistakes that could lead to defeat. This would have produced a further fatal erosion of morale. While Operations Beresford and Bulimba were poorly executed, that did not result in being decisively defeated. It did result in some unnecessary and heavy casualties. It was Rommel that had been decisively beaten in what would be his last attempt to reach Cairo. Montgomery's first success in North Africa, it set 8th Army on the road to recovery from the bewilderment and the many disasters from May through to July 1942. It was the beginning of something new as air and ground cooperation now went up a gear and paid dividends. It left Montgomery free to plan and prepare his own Battle of Alamein, where these dividends would be fully exploited. As the British official history noted, their forces growing stronger every day, and I'm quoting from British official history, the initiative was there for the taking, and Montgomery was determined to seize it. When he felt his army was ready, he would strike against the Rommel's Panzer Army with all the considerable force at his disposal, and that is the Battle of Al Alamein, the second Battle of Al Alamein, which is another story. Thank you.
Well done, Glenn. I think we've got time for questions. I'm sure there must be some. Richard.
John, can I make a couple of points?
Sure.
the context of a sort of May through August 42 period, of course, there's the huge dilemma of what's happening on the Russian front. And through most of that period, the British decision and the Americans, who were, of course, learning their way into the war, was in fact sending supplies to the Russians, because the one thing they did not want to have was Russians sued for a separate peace. And so that period, and it's symbolised in July 1942, when convoy PQ-17 gets decimated, and it appears that even the supplies aren't going to get through to Russia. So the issue of the Eighth Army's equipment is a key issue for the guys on the battlefield, but is also reflective of other priorities around the fighting the war at the time. Do you have any comment on that?
No, I would agree with what you're saying. I mean, the need to keep the Soviet Union in the fight is absolutely critical, because that's where the bulk of the German army is. They're not in North Africa. You know, there are only 200 divisions fighting. Having said that, with the fall of Tobruk, that's one of these moments where they consider, oh, we really need to be doing something about here. And Churchill happened to be in Washington at the time, and FDR said to him, tell us what you need. Tell me what you need to change the situation. And Churchill said, asked him, what do we need? You know, and he said, oh, we need all this artillery and we need tanks, and better tanks, we need more grants, and hopefully the Shermans when they become available. And they do put an emergency run basically over there so they can replace them very, very quickly. Don't arrive in time for Allan Halfa, but they do arrive in time for the Second Battle of Allen. So they actually do start to prioritise. The thing is, too, though, with the Enigma intercepts, they are being used to deny Rommel the supplies that he needs by basically sinking all those supply ships that are on his way, which they know are coming, and that seriously hampers Rommel in North Africa. The logistical battle is being decidedly won by the Allies through the use of the intelligence and what they're doing about it.
Thanks.
How wrong was known who was in charge of the, Montgomery and in charge of the Allies?
Several ways. He had his own intelligence sources, and they were very good. He had his own wireless intercept, which the Australians actually captured at Tal Alisha. They kept him very, very well informed. And the other thing that's only come out about in the last 10 or 15 years is that the American attaché in Egypt, Colonel Fellers, his code had been broken by his cleaner. His Italian cleaner had got into a safe and photographed it and given it to the Germans. And every communication that he was making back to Washington was in Rommel's hands within the space of 48 hours. And Fellers were saying, well, the British are really worried about this, and, you know, they're worried about their anti-tank guns, and they think that Rommel's going to... You know. So Rommel was remarkably well informed until in early July, when the Australians in Tal Alisha actually captured the signals intelligence intercept unit, and that kept Rommel somewhat blind. But he was really well informed about who was commanding, and primarily through intercept on radios. And I've got to say, up until the Battle of El Alamein and Montgomery arriving, 8th Army was notoriously slack in its radio discipline. You know, in terms of codes, they would, you know, be talking about, you know, over the wire in clear, you know, and to a commander's nicknames, and the Germans all knew who Blinky was and so on. Their radio procedure was appalling up until Montgomery arrived and said something we have to tighten up on.
Any other questions? Well, they get home for dinner. Oh, sorry. I'll come to you in a minute.
Your comment about the tanks being sent by President Roosevelt, that was a particularly difficult decision for the Americans, because they were from starting a very small army. Yep. They were now trying to expand in a huge way, and those tanks were taken off the American army, and they were not happy about that.
Oh, no, they weren't. In fact, the General Marshall was really upset about doing that. And Churchill quite rightly says in the history, it was a very generous decision of Roosevelt to do that. He's absolutely right. They're trying to build up their own army from scratch. They need this equipment, and these are their latest versions of the tanks that they're producing. The Grant has no large problems. The Sherman becomes their workhorse. and they need them as much as the British do, but Roosevelt made the decision, while the British are fighting this battle now, they'll need them, otherwise they may lose Egypt, and to lose Egypt would have been a huge blow for the Allies.
Just mentioning that German army is professional against just amateurs from the Commonwealth, that's quite a different setup. I think until the British got the 6-pounder, which they took, the 2-pounder, the biggest advantage the Germans really had, which not, well, it is mentioned in the books, of course, their 88mm anti-aircraft flat gun at point blank range on tanks is just ridiculous, like Hercules against just an ant, you know.
Yep.
But the British could have taken out a lot more German tanks, like 3s and 4 Panzers, with side, blowing the tracks off. It's those 88s got all before they got in the air, because their British range was only like 200 yards.
Yeah, absolutely. They were certainly outgunned. You know, that's some of the comments that are coming through here. The 88 is an interesting weapon because it's a dual-purpose one, anti-aircraft gun, but also very effective against tanks. The British actually had a similar model, but their mindset was, oh, this is an anti-aircraft gun, you know, we can't use it in a dual role, because when you use it in a dual role, it puts up all this dust, and we don't want our soldiers fighting in the dust, you know. They did trial it, and it worked very effectively, but they couldn't...
It's not the boat, Mike, but there was
a lot of boat. No, it's a different gun to the boaters, yeah. But you know, their mindset was, you know, we can't use this, this is not for that role. But you're absolutely right, the 6-pounder made a critical difference. Who was it that described the 2-pounders like having a matchstick on wheels? You know, that's very, very effective and very disheartening seeing shells bounce off German armour when they come in close. So it did make a critical difference. Of course, they even produced an even larger anti-tank gun later as well.
Okay, any final? Yeah.
Just one last question. With regard to the airborne assault that happened at Crete,
yep,
with Kurt's student's army, if there hadn't been quite so much losses, and they hadn't forbade any further operations, do you believe that the Germans would have taken out Malta and therefore cut half the supplies that were being sunk from?
It's certainly an option. It's quite interesting how people react to seeing a technology or a new system used. It's like the British in the First World War, they invent the tank, and all they see are the problems with it, but the Germans on the other end of it see how effective they are. In Crete, all the Germans see are the heavy losses and the fact that these are their best and brightest, and you know, Hitler says we're not going to use this again, but the British and the Americans actually do a study on it. How airborne troops, that's what we need to use and develop that technology. If they kept it up and taken Malta, you know, it's one of these big what ifs, and it probably would have certainly, I think, had a significant impact, and may have prolonged the North African campaign even longer. But it's one of those what ifs that you just don't know.
All right. I guess one of the other things to just bear in mind is Glenn's mentioned about the the logistical support. The Africa Corps was very poorly supplied. A lot of their supply convoys were taken out because the Allies knew when the convoys were coming. The other interesting thing is that the North African campaign was just as much a win for the logistical system, because the railway that they put in from Alexandria into Libya, about 300 miles worth, was put in a matter of weeks. And that enabled the Allies to actually get, train loads, particularly during the night, because during the day they were interdicted by the Luftwaffe. But they were able to get all their resupply, their ammunition, their reinforcements, the water, the petrol, oil, and lubricants from, you know, east to west in a big hurry, and kept the Allied organisations pretty well supplied. And that is a very important factor that I think a lot of people forget about. Anyway, a number of thanks to particularly to Glyn, but also I just want to recognise a number of other people here who contribute to the success of these presentations. Firstly, to Joe Buckland and the team from the City Library, She's the person that sends out all the email invitations and the reminders and everybody else and everything else. Also to Stuart Burks here, who records all of these presentations so that we're actually able to upload the audios from these presentations together with the PowerPoint packages and sometimes the scripts. And we have that that information on our website now for the last 2.5 years worth of presentations. A lot of people say, hey, sorry, I can't make it tonight, but can I have a look at the presentation online? And I'm just working with the City Library to see if we can establish a link between City Library and Manawatu Heritage where you can access all of these presentations on the engineer website. So that's another work in progress. So, you know, thanks, Stuart, for your recordings. I think are very important. And also to yourselves for turning up on a cold night. So once again, please join me in thanking Liv. Thank you.